Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, March 9th, the Keep It Dusty edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of NPR's Invisibilia. In New York, I'm joined by June Thomas, who's now the managing producer of Slate Podcasts. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah.
Can I run something very random by you guys? Have you guys seen Mad Max?
No.
I never have.
Oh, okay.
So maybe you can't.
So you can run it, but...
You know, the Charlize Theron version?
Yeah.
Because I watched it on an airplane having heard it's all feminist and whatnot, so I turned it on the airplane. So not feminist. She's not Max. She's not really the main character. And then they have these, like, Vogue models who kind of dominate the screen, who are the ladies. They're like the virgins. No, they're not the virgins, the opposite. They're like the breeders for the horrible guy, and they just take up a lot of the screen, and they really are like out of a fashion spread, despite the fact that they're going through mud and dirt. Anyway, if any listeners out there can explain to me, like, how is Matt, since you guys can't, how is Mad Max, like, how did it get the reputation for being feminist? Like, merely because she's there and she drives the truck? I don't really get it.
I just want to put a word in for the 100 on the CW, which is one of those like terrible things are happening shows. And even though all the people on it are gorgeous, they do look filthy dirty and always like injured and covered in scars. And so I want to give them some compliments for being so dirty and dusty and real looking.
Exactly. That's going to be our theme for today. Keep it dusty.
All right. I'm pumped.
Keep it dusty. Okay. So our three topics for today, the women's strike. What is it for? What is it supposed to accomplish? Second, Happily Ever After is no longer cool. Movies and TVs are going through a soulmate backlash. We discuss. And finally, PMS, a new debate about whether it's real. I can already hear you grumbling there in the background. And then in our Slate Plus segment, do you want to say what we're going to talk about?
We're going to ask, is eating your steak well done, possibly with ketchup, sexist?
I thought it was just, is steak sexist? Because I kind of steak itself is sexist. Why don't we leave it for the conversation?
Okay. Yes, okay.
You'll see, listeners, for our Slate Plus listeners, if you want to hear us discuss steak and whether it's sexist, you'll have to become a Slate Plus member for that extra segment. We'll do that at the end. All right, the women's strike. It is technically called A Day Without a Woman. The strike was intended to draw attention to the invisible or underappreciated work that women do and just generally kind of to protest Trump. Not kind of. It was to protest Trump. So let me ask you guys, full disclosure here, we're recording on the day of the women's strike. Today is Wednesday. We record on Wednesdays. You guys, in what manner would you say you are striking? Are you wearing red, for example?
I intended to wear red. I have this red sweater that's so bright red, it completely washes me out and I can't wear it. But I thought today would be a perfect day. But then I was in a big hurry this morning and I forgot. So only in theory am I wearing red. But in, I'm actually...
That's a no.
It's a no. In no way, actually, am I striking. So there you go.
And Noreen?
I'm wearing what I thought was a red sweater. I come in, June tells me it's maroon.
Yeah.
So the women of The Cut at New York Magazine are going entirely dark for the day. They have put up a message about why they're striking and they are going off to protest. I work for a different part of New York Magazine. I work for the print edition. And I made the decision that if I were to strike, it wouldn't really stick it to the man or patriarchy or capitalism. It would just screw me over because I still have to do the work and I would end up doing it at night or on my couch while I was supposedly striking. And so I'm not striking. I'm going to the office, but a bunch of women are all going to go have lunch and drink a bottle of wine together today. So that's our version of striking.
What about you, Hannah?
You know, I'm reading The Cut now. It's kind of beautiful what they did. Everyone should check it out. It's just like a big red banner, and then it explains what they're doing that day. So I guess we are the type of people who should strike. It's not a huge cost for us. We're obviously not going to get fired. We could explain it to our employers. I am not striking. I guess I don't understand action that's not collective, and this is a blind spot on my part. Like, I can go somewhere and collectively do something, but I couldn't get my head around a strike, which was, like you said, Noreen, me sitting at home and just like working remotely. Like I couldn't understand it as a strike. Now that's very limited because there are other women's strikes. We've read about them all this week, like the one in Poland. They actually have accomplished things, huge things in the case of Poland, which is blocking an anti-abortion law.
Women in Ireland are striking today, March 8th, International Women's Day, for the right to abortion in Ireland. That feels like
teachers.
The Alexandria City schools are closed because so many teachers put in for a personal day.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that makes a lot of sense to me because that is a category of women's work which is undervalued and underappreciated. Like teaching is one of those categories where teachers in America get paid a lot less or less valued than teachers, say, in China or in Finland or other places that have stronger education systems. So that is one category that is good to show people we have power. You know, like we exist, we have power, we teach your children, we can shut down your school. So
although,
that seems good to me.
As a lot of people pointed out, the people who are then inconvenienced are women. And if they're middle-class women or women who have the kinds of jobs where, yeah, it's really no big deal to you just take a personal day, that's one thing. But as we know, for a lot of women, having to suddenly deal with their kids for one day can be really, really disruptive and you know, potentially even put their jobs at risk.
Yeah.
Well, that's the version of the strike I loved. Like Vogue had a list. It was like a list to the men of what you should do. Mm. You know, I like that domestic striking. And Iceland, when Iceland did a version of this, they put these ads everywhere. It was like, you make the dinner. I'm not going to buy the ingredients and lay them out on the counter. I'm not going to tell you when the kids are coming home from school. Just you do it. I mean, mm-hmm. It's a little like nasty to the partner, but I felt like that felt real to me in some way, like as a thing that you could do. I mean, I have a responsible husband. He does many things, but still, it did feel like if you just abdicate that mm-hmm. felt like a feeling of freedom and a little bit radical to me. Like that felt like liberation.
One of the other things that we read about was in one place, I thought it was Iceland, but maybe it was somewhere else, women stopped working at the time when men earn what they on average earn. So probably about 3 o'clock or 2:30.
Yeah, it was like two, they left work 2 hours early. I love that.
That seems really good.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's really good. Okay. So the bigger questions besides, you know, what we should all do and what we're doing, what is the message of the strike and how important is it that we don't go or other people? Like, what's the symbolic importance of the strike? First of all, it seems interesting to me that it's in the opposite ethos of Lean In. I'm sure you guys read that a lot. Like, it's giving the opposite. It's kind of in the opposite spirit. Mm-hmm. What do you guys think of that? Like, it's not Lean In. It's not like we're playing by the rules of the man. Like, it's sort of moving in the opposite direction.
Yeah, it really is, because a big component of it actually is anti-capitalist, which I think has been a little bit under-discussed. You're not supposed to shop in addition to, you know, not going to work.
Except in small women-owned or minority-owned businesses.
I miss that. Okay. Well, I'll be fine in Brooklyn. Just kidding. So I do think that this is an interesting strain of Trump-era feminism, is that it is moving away from sort of like working within a men's system kind of feminism, which is what we arguably had for the last 8 years with Sheryl Sandberg as the avatar of it. But this particular strike doesn't seem to me, maybe I'm wrong here, it doesn't seem to me to be all that related to Donald Trump in the way that the Women's March was. This just seems to be taking a lot of the energy that people have around activism right now and sort of turning it into something that is more purely grassroots feminist oriented. Is that, do you guys think that's fair?
No.
You think it's about Donald Trump?
I don't. Well, I think there's an interesting moment in which the women's movement and the issues of the women's movement and the kind of patriarchy in our face moment that we live in right now has made the women's movement more relevant. Mm. So it's not that it's anti-Trump. It's that it's become the central repository for anti-Trumpness, that the women's movement has become that in our culture right now. And that's interesting. I don't know if that will last or will remain that, like, as opposed to, say, the environmental movement or all the ways that activism gets triggered. It's the women's movement that seems to be leading things.
Yeah, I guess this is one of the most annoying critiques to make of marches or strikes, but I feel like the demands here are unclear as ever. And particularly coming, you know, a day or two after, you know, we find out that the new Trump Care is going to defund Planned Parenthood. And in addition to that, it's not even going to cover things like maternity care. I wish that there were, you know, to me, that's a very, very clear thing that I wish the women's movement were organizing around. And I'm sure that people are and that that will continue to go forward. But it just seems weird that this strike that's happening 2 days after is not exactly. And I'm sure, listen, I'm sure at all the rallies today that people will talk about that. But it just feels a little dissociated at the moment.
Yeah, I guess for me, I think the reason I'm not striking is I think that my work is actually kind of advocational around the same issues. Like, I think by doing this podcast, we're making similar points to people who are protesting, you know, we maybe even reaching more people. So that's how I excuse my lack of activism. But I also am very aware of how different this feels from the Day Without Immigrants, which I didn't do only because I didn't know about it until it was too late. But I actually think I would have been more likely to participate in that because I think it would be really striking to realize how much our lives are touched by immigrants beyond the obvious things that first come to mind. Whereas for women, I think we really know how important women are. There may be some, you know, oh, wow, yeah, that too. But it's known. And so I think maybe if there were a clearer, we are fighting for X, then maybe I might have been stirred to participate more actively.
Mm-hmm. You know, June, I felt the same way. I'm an immigrant. I would participate in the Day Without Immigrants. But I think that maybe that the reason I said that is just a little shame around white woman privilege. In other words, that I can get behind I can get behind the cause of immigrants because it's very clear to me in the ways in which immigrants are targeted or underappreciated or living in the shadows. But me aligning with my sense of, being a woman and being discriminated against, like, I can't point easily to ways in which I'm suffering as a woman, me personally, not women as a class. And I can point to the way immigrants are suffering. Like, it's an easier cause to get behind.
Right.
Immigrants.
Well, Gia,
do you think that's true of you?
Yes, I do.
Gia Tolentino had a good piece on the New Yorker's website. There was a lot of discussion in the lead up to this that, you know, it's going to end up being a privileged women's strike, obviously. And I thought her point was good, that, like, if you want to strike and you can strike, you should do it. Don't feel guilt about it. There are people who in a very real way can't. And on some level, you're striking for them. Mm-hmm. And maybe that feels a little Lady Bountiful to say, but actually, you know, raising raising awareness in the streets in that way. Like, if you are, let's say, like a freelance writer who lives at home and can make your own hours, go out and do it. Don't feel weird about it.
Can I ask you guys about the pro-life women? Because I'm thinking about this a lot. Sort of how big should this tent be and who do you get to include? And how does this whole thing not devolve into, you know, fine-tuned arguments about who gets included and who doesn't get included? You know, Ivanka Trump today tweeted, you know, yay, Women's Day. You know, pro-life feminists have asked to become part of it. How big do you guys stretch this? How big would you let it get?
I have to say, I feel a little more, I have to say, I'm more open to opening the tent today because it's International Women's Day. That's why this day was chosen. It's something that America hasn't typically paid much attention to, but in other parts of the world, it's a big deal. I used to go on marches with my charanga in Spain. Mm-hmm. I could sing a little song about the 8th of March. And I think it's...
Always.
Ocho de marzo, hoy es mi día, voy a alegrar todo al alma mía. But so I think it's great that we're actually paying attention to the fact that around the world, like, this is an international cause. And I also think it's for all women. And whereas for a feminist march, there might be discussions about does being anti-choice disqualify you from taking place. But I think when it's Women's Day, it's for all women.
Yeah, this goes back to the question of like, what are the aims? What are the demands? And I think it was so much clearer in some sense that the January march was anti-Donald Trump. And I don't think Ivanka was invited to that one. But I'm rolling my eyes at her posts in support of it, but I also think that, okay, fine. Like, if you, one of her big things is highlighting women's work, fine. Mm-hmm. If you wanna, you know, do this PR gambit for your book that's rolling out this May, go ahead, Ivanka, go ahead and do it. And more sincerely, I feel that the pro-life women's groups, I don't see a reason why they shouldn't be included in this. They are women who, do work. And I bet if you look at a lot of these sort of like groups of immigrant women, for instance, who I think organizers would be happy to highlight, I bet a lot of them actually are pro-life. Mm-hmm. So I think that opening up the tent in this instance is a good thing.
Yeah, I would do it more broadly for pro-life thing. I don't really get that one. Like, I think you can be a pro-life woman who believes, you know, if the fundamental beliefs is you think that there should be equality for women, agency for women in society, you know, if you believe in contraception and you just happen to have a religious objection and you are pro-life, that's fine with me. You can be let in, as far as I'm concerned. All right. Well, listeners, let us know if you took the day off, if you wore red, or if you didn't, why or why not? We are curious how people have engaged with the day off. All right, our second topic. Last week, Danielle Friedman in New York Magazine made the argument that culture was moving away from happily ever after, from the idea that every one of us has a soulmate and destiny will drop that person in our lap. So her main examples were La La Land, where they meet cute, but they don't end up together, The Good Place, and Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, all of which I personally love. Mm-hmm. I thought this piece was great. I'm saying that to you, Noreen, as if you edited it. You probably had nothing to do with it.
I had nothing to do with it.
You had nothing to do with it. I thought it was really great. Like, it for, you know, these are three bits of culture that I personally really, that I like, and it made me realize, like, I like them for this reason. But before we get into the bits themselves, I'm going to ask you, Noreen, since you're the, you know, dating person among us. Because it does feel, do you feel like one of the arguments she made was that it reflects, you know, the just like realities of dating culture in a way. Like, nobody thinks that way. That's not what drives people anymore.
Yeah, I think it's a really smart argument that she made. She kind of draws a line between online dating and this new kind of rom-com. She says, like, oh, if you've ever been on like a Tinder date, you know there is no such thing as true love, which is sort of a dark view. But I don't know that I would pin it so clearly on that, although I'm sure that has something to do with it. To me, it's more like you know, peak TV or whatever moment we're in, where there's just so much more you know, televisual culture, right? There's so many more options. TV has gotten so much smarter. And so, of course, people are going to explore things in a more nuanced way. This actually, you know, I love a classic rom-com. If I'm at home on a Saturday night and Pretty Woman is on TV, I will watch that always. But you know, a few years ago, I think we even talked in this podcast about the death of the rom-com and how it was over and Hollywood wasn't making them anymore. And it made me realize that actually, no, I have been consuming rom-coms for the past, you know, 5 or 6 years when they're supposedly dead. They're just in this other form. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's Unreal. It's even Girls. It's all, I mean, this is just towards a broader definition of rom-com is what I would say this piece and another accompanying essay in Vulture are arguing for.
You know, I have another theory, which I think the author of this piece kind of starts on the journey. And I would take a little further that perhaps Bachelor and Bachelorette and that whole universe of shows may also be responsible for the death or the evolution of the rom-com. You know, people are so into The Bachelor, you know, with these viewing parties. Again, this is something we've talked about on the show. And the way that that show operates, even though there's not much calm involved, it is so subverting of, you know, our notions of romance and yet also kind of reifying them in a way that I think that's also another reason that we just can't take seriously these notions of meet cute and, oh my God, these people are just fighting. Oh, wow, suddenly they're kissing. Oh, wow, they're going to be together forever. Like, there's just too many other undermining messages around.
Yeah, it's almost become like it's like a question of taste. Like a happy ending is a mainstream, vaguely tacky thing these mm-hmm. days. And if you want to be like indie and cool, you make your people so clearly suited for each other, but then they don't end up together because that's the way life is, man. You know, it's it's, you know, none of these things that we've talked about with the possible exception of La La Land are huge hits, actually. Right? They're I think La La Land did very well at the box office, but Happy Ending, those big dumb Katherine Heigl, you know, rom-coms that were critically panned, I think probably got a lot more viewers than mm-hmm. Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, even if you add up all of the views of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, yeah, which is a little depressing.
Yeah, but it is. I mean, that is the sad thing, that these quality versions, you know, some other examples as well as the ones that have already been name-checked, Master of None, Aziz Ansari's Netflix show, Scrotal Recall, now rebranded as Lovesick.
amazing rebrand.
Oh, no, we're going to go deep in
June here. All right, we'll go a little less obscure, but, you know, Catastrophe in a sense, Insecure. There's just lots of these shows now where there's a very, you know, much more nuanced version of love. And it's not necessarily that they're definitely breaking up or they're never going to see each other, although in some cases that seems to be the message. But just the focus is on working through the difficulties rather than, you know, a big, you know, one of those wonderful, the sun comes out, you know, go ta-da and everything, like, oh my God, yes, you're beautiful, Miss Smith, you know, that we don't want that anymore.
Yeah.
But you know what? I feel sad listening to this conversation because it feels like this is a stressful world. I mean, it's one thing to have, you know, nostalgia for it and kind of understand in some part of your mind that there is no soulmate or there might not be any soulmate. But to give up on it entirely and have a version of Groundhog Day where you just feel like, okay, you're just rolling through the same things, or, you know, in a way, The Good Place mm-hmm. is incredibly subversive on yeah. the question of the soulmate. I'm not going to give away the ending, but it's really subversive.
Indeed.
And the way The Bachelor, which I do watch and am watching right now, I intermittently dip in and out of The Bachelor. It's a great pleasure that my daughter and I share. Is so Catherine Van Arendonk, I don't know how to pronounce her name.
I think it is Arendonk.
Arendonk. She wrote a great piece about The Bachelor's meta-ness, how it simultaneously reifies this yearning we have and destroys it in so many ways. But it's one thing to not believe in a soulmate, and it's another thing to not believe that there's a person out there ever that you could settle with. I mean, in La La Land, I guess it's ambiguous whether she's happy. You know, like the end is a moment of yearning And there's no indication that she's not happy in the life that she's chosen, that either of them is not happy in the life that they're chosen. It's just that they that you can maybe it's a positive ending that you can miss that kind of that sort of destiny person, but still have a wonderful life. Is that the positive? Does it depress you, Noreen? Like when you're walking around the earth, you're like, well, there's no soulmate, so there's nothing? Or you just think there's no soulmate and that's good because I'll just find a person and be fine with it.
I don't think I've believed in a soulmate in like 25 years, man. The way that I hear people talk about this is I'm looking for my person, which I think is a really nice phrase. Like, you know, just like your best friend, just like the person you want to tell things to. That's I think the phrase that has replaced soulmate, and that is, you know, still a hard thing to find, but easier to find than a soulmate. Just like a human. I'm just looking for a human.
Just looking for a human to dynamically insert. You know.
But I do think that you know, if you sit around watching Meg Ryan movies all the time while you're trying to date, that is actually far more counterproductive than watching. Like now when you watch television, if you're a person who's, you know, dating, you're like, oh, I'm less screwed up than they are. You know, it just allows for the possibility that things start and they stop and then they start again. You know, it's not this perfect narrative.
How is this different than how I'm asking this without any judgment or inflection. How is a person, which I agree, that's a good word, different from, remember how pissed off we all were at Lori Gottlieb, the case for settling, you know, the case for good enough. How are those two things different? Because we don't like settling. It pisses us off to think that we settled.
Well, it's not a person. It's my person. I think the possessive pronoun is super important there. Mm-hmm. And then you there's sort of some agency in deciding to make that a person, your person, like when it becomes my person. That's the big deal. I don't know. This is all semantics. But
no, I think it's really good. Like the way in Esther Perel, you know, the affair lady, she's about to come out with a new book. She's the one who has 50 million TED Talk listeners. She's always criticizing us for putting too much the modern American marriage for putting too much investment in a partner, expecting a partner to be absolutely everything. And maybe this is the walk back from that, you know, like a little bit of a walk back from that, my person. It's a little more realistic and makes for better marriages, ultimately.
I feel like I'm making the phrase my person sound way less charming than it actually is in real life. It's not this sort of sad shrug. Yeah, that's my person. It's like, oh, I found my person, you know. It's really, I think it's a nice thing.
I would say, too, that just to bring this back to rom-coms, just like in dating, maybe we're less idealistic or less sort of insane about what we're looking for. In rom-coms or in the kind of shows that are focused on relationships, we're just admitting that we know more now. We admit that we've already seen all those Meg Ryan movies, that we already know how Gwyneth Paltrow, you know, worked out on Sliding Doors. I'm thinking, for example, of The Mindy Project, which has done two episodes that very explicitly are versions of rom-com movies. So she did a version of Sliding Doors. This season, she did a version of Groundhog Day. And, you know, that's one particular thing. But I really like how that we're just kind of admitting, we're just explicit about all the things that we know now. We're not pretending that, oh my goodness, rom-coms, you mean that there might be an unlikely pairing, but they're actually perfect for each other? Like, we know how that narrative works. And we can now enjoy it and mess with it. We don't have to pretend like, I can't believe that Katharine Hepburn's going to get it together with Spencer Tracy, because of course she is. And we don't even have to, you know, pretend not to care anymore.
I like that theory. So it's just like we're more sophisticated consumers. That's what that theory is.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily some huge shift in the culture. It's like we are tired. We have so much good culture to consume now that the formula is just get ever more fine-tuned to the moment we're in and ever more sophisticated.
And right? I think that's true. If you really think about the way online dating has affected people's dating lives, it actually makes it more episodic in like kind of if you watch a 90s sitcom where they've got a new new, they've got a new date every episode, or even Sex and the City, there's like a constant parade of characters. It feels more like that for people who are online dating rather than like, oh, I'm sad and broken and I'm going to end up alone. You know, I think that is just people being formally experimental.
Okay. Here, here for formal experimentation. Okay. Well, let's move on to our third topic. Is PMS real or a figment of our menstruation-fearing culture? This theory was raised in a very interesting book called The Geography of Madness, Penis Thieves, Voodoo Death, and the Search for Meaning of the World's Strangest Syndromes. And the author, who's unfortunately a man, I think that was his downfall in making this argument, if you read the comments on his excerpt, he should have just let his, like his lady friend just advance this particular part of the argument, that there are these cultural syndromes, like these cultural idioms of distress, that essentially you can go from one culture to the other, and some cultures recognize a set of symptoms as belonging to a kind of syndrome, in this case, PMS, menstruation, and some cultures just don't really notice them, which is not to say that they're made up, right? I mean, you guys are with me. He's not saying like they're invented or they're not real. He's just saying we notice them or we don't notice them in certain cultures.
Oh, we talk about them, perhaps.
Well, we should preface this by saying that this article came out in November and I made you guys talk about it. I kept bringing it up every time we were discussing topics like that PMS thing is an evergreen because it made me so angry back in November. And I've held on to some of that anger, which I'm ready to unfurl here today.
I'm just going to step back a little bit because I have a feeling that Noreen's gonna explode.
Well, okay. So we should walk through a little more clearly what he's saying. So so first of all, I was interested to learn that I sort of understood PMS as an outcropping of hormonal, you know, fluctuations. Apparently that's not entirely true. It comes alongside hormonal fluctuations. But they haven't really linked all of the symptoms to that, which is interesting to me. So they don't really know where it comes from when you're in a bad mood right before your period. Now, I'm no scientist, but it just seems like...
Here we go.
It just seems like...
I'm no scientist.
But I am a menstruator. It just seems like it has to be linked. Come on. Like... It's just, what else is it?
Yeah.
I have no argument for this man other than that you are wrong, and I feel it in my bones every 28 days how wrong you are. So that's
what my friend was like. How can it not? It's just like two loops on the belt buckle. Like, it has to be real. Like, I can show you on right. my belt buckle, like the days before and the days after.
And I think part of the problem, you know, they have trouble. Like, it turns out that something like only 15% of women present classic PMS symptoms, which is like, you know, this very specific set of things that goes away the instant you get your period. That's because every woman's body is different. And like, you're, you know, you might have weird breast tenderness while your friend has like
absolute raging anger,
right? Like
on the reg,
right? And so there's no such thing, I think, as classic PMS right. symptoms. But the interesting part of his argument is that okay, in China, supposedly women complain about being cold a lot during their periods, and that is not something we really do here in America. So maybe there is some cultural bit to it.
But what about the fact that we see it as negative? Like, that's part of the argument that I, you know, of course, there's the Papua New Guinea example.
Can we talk about that specific one? Because that is my demand for the women's strike, actually, that we act as the people do of Papua New Guinea, in which the men have to menstruate, which they do by going out into the ocean and inducing an erection, pulling their foreskin back, taking a crab from the ocean and making their penis bleed. And then they like clean it off in the water and then with some leaves and then they've menstruated.
I'm going to go into the crab business right now.
When I pictured that scene, I pictured like a bunch of women standing cross-armed on yes. the shore being like, keep more, bleed more.
So horrible.
Keep it up, crabby.
I need you to do that for 7 days.
Oh my gosh. Right.
But where it's seen as like cleansing and powerful. And so you may feel these things, but you may not interpret them as negative. Like, I am influenced by the idea that, you know, even in the Torah, menstruation is like a terrible, unclean, dirty business, you know, to get back to Mad Max. It's just like, it's just like you're dirty and dusty when you're menstruating. And so we have been taught deep in our souls to see it as a bad thing, and as something that makes us miserable, just like we are cursed with childbirth. And so, as opposed to just like, oh, it's happening, like I'm a little bloated today or whatever, like unbuckle the belt loop. Instead, it's just this misery. Although I will say, when I was a teenager, I was pretty freaking miserable, and I used to have to take off school because I was so ill and miserable. So, which I think is a thing.
Like, yeah,
absolutely. You know, that happens to teenage girls.
Yeah,
and to some grown women too.
Yeah, people throw up. It just and it changes at different points of your life. Mm-hmm. I think it's just like, I don't know. I was also interested to read that some feminist scholars had argued in favor of menstruation as in part or PMS as in part a cultural construct because it allowed women to you know experience their anger fully in the way that they don't allow themselves to the rest of the month. I like if I'm just sitting there reading that in a book, I like the idea of that. But in actual practice, I don't want to, like, I'm not looking for an excuse to be angry in it. And at least for me, it feels like I'm not driving the bus in that, like, you know, 16 hours where I experience it most acutely. And I don't like that feeling. Mm-hmm.
We're going to try a thought experiment.
All right.
And listeners are going to do it with us. Here's the thought experiment. Next time you're PMSing, it's not really a verb, but you know what I mean. next time you're PMSing, just try a framework shift. Like, just try and tell yourself, like, this is good. Like, I'm tapping into my woman rage here, and this is a positive experience for me, and I'm just powerful, you know? You don't have to tell your man to do the crab thing or anything like that. But just
you can if you want.
You can if you want to. We wouldn't object. But just try the frame shift and see if it does anything for you. Like, see if it makes you less miserable.
Why should we, like, have to do that? I'm serious. Like, women, we you know, like, can't we just
say... We're terribly accommodating all...
Yeah, exactly. Can't we just say, this sucks and I'm going to complain about it? I actually think we should talk more about how annoying it is. And one of my favorite things on the internet ever was a BuzzFeed quiz called How Heavy Metal Is Your Period? And you had to, like, take a quiz, and it, you know, it's talked about all the, like, painful and annoying and possibly grotesque things that happen. And I liked that. Uh-huh. I think it's like, okay, let's acknowledge that it is actually hard, not like try to do some magical thinking around it. Like, oh, I am superwoman. I'm not feeling these cramps. Like, no, come on.
Yeah. It is annoying too, that there is no, that there is still all of these unknowns about PMS, because apparently people aren't studying it. I mean, there were a few studies which seemed to be inconclusive, which I would guess that if they were about other topics, say, well, okay, they're inconclusive, let's keep studying. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't seem to be much interest or effort. I mean,
why do you want people to study it? Like, so that we take a pill and it goes away?
No. I mean, well, although for those women who need that, sure, that would be good. But, it, you know, for example, one of the things that we read was women saying, hey, listen, this is really a big thing for me. And because it's often dismissed, I am dismissed and I really would like a cure. So, yeah, I mean, and some women would like a pill that they could take. I mean, that's the nature of medical research, right? That not everything will kill you. Just because something won't kill you doesn't mean we don't study it. And I'm frankly astonished that the big pharma isn't spending a lot of money, because, they put their money, their research money, where their income potential is.
Right. And some people who have PMDD, which is the severe version of it, do take antidepressants during that. Mm. And actually, Ilette Waldman, who just wrote a book about microdosing LSD, actually got into that as a way of dealing with her PMDD.
Wow.
She just, you know, she was looking for DIY hacks, and that's the one that came along. So people are, outside of big pharma, kind of experimenting with new ways to do it. But, like, the fact that people are, forced to self medicate in that way, mm-hmm. you know, if it were, you know, this is like such a cliche to say, but if men were doing it, there would be a lot more attention paid to it.
Yeah.
Verilyn jumping in just to say, I'm sitting here feeling all this guilt because it wasn't until I was 24 and I was on the IUD and I got all these cramps did I really understand what, when women that said they were had cramps, yeah. what that meant.
Yeah.
And I remember feeling like, you know, girls in high school that were like, oh, I have cramps. I can't do this. I remember being like, girl, like everyone had, like, just get it together, yeah. you know? And I think the issue is you don't really understand because women just keep going. Yeah. And I remember feeling like, oh, this is not okay. I'm not going on as regular because this shit hurts.
Yeah, I'm at the age where my friends' teenage daughters are going through this and they're so miserable. So it's the conversation is around, am I allowed to give her birth control, which stops her period because she's so miserable all the time? Or is that just a bad thing to do for 100 reasons? Anyway.
That seems complicated.
All right, you guys win. You guys win. It's terrible. Don't pretend it's anything but terrible. Everyone just kind of come on in and complain. That's good.
Thank you guys for indulging me in talking about this. I really, it just made me so mad, this thing that happened on the internet 3 months ago.
I need to go in there because I need to organize a strike for PMS.
Yeah, exactly.
It'll be every 28 days.
Noreen, anytime you have like a lady thing that is bothering you, just bring it up and
we'll discuss it 3 months later.
I won't.
We'll discuss it.
I won't. I'm actually too repressed for that, but thank you for the offer.
Sure. Okay, our recommendations. Let's move on to those. Noreen, what do you have for us?
I am going to recommend a movie that I haven't seen in a little while, and I'm sure that I've recommended on here before, or maybe we even discussed it as a threesome. But the original 1939 version of The Women, starring Joan Crawford, among other luminaries. And I was just reminded of the movie because there is this Ryan Murphy miniseries called Feud, about the feud between Bette Davis and Joan Crawford. And if you want to see Joan Crawford at the height of her powers, and you also want to see a movie about women kind of undermining each other, watch The Women. It's an all-female cast. It's like crackling dialogue. It's truly fantastic. And it feels surprisingly modern, and probably, I actually haven't seen the Meg Ryan, Jennifer Lopez version, but I bet it feels more modern than that version.
You recall we actually did a segment about
That's what I thought it was, but that was a couple of years ago. So if we have new listeners or if you didn't tune in, The Women, 1939 version only, please.
Yes, that's a great movie. Okay, so I think because I watched Mad Max and I was like, what? That I needed a little big reality check. So I picked up Joy Williams, who a friend had recommended to me. She has a book of short stories called The Visiting Privilege, which is so good. It's a kind of cruelty and humor and realism of the Flannery O'Connor school, which I just personally deeply, deeply appreciate. And if you need an introduction to Joy Williams, Dan Coyce, who is a Slate staffer, wrote a story in the New York Times, actually, called The Misanthropic Genius of Joy Williams. Okay. June, what do you have?
So I want to thank one of our listeners for my recommendation. After the last episode, when I recommended the little bits at the end of Perry Mason between Della Street and Perry and sometimes Paul Drake, Nathan Gelgud tweeted at me about an essay about the Perry Mason family, and I looked it up and I read it, and it's fantastic. It's called The Little Church of Perry Mason, and it's by Dave Hickey in his collection Air Guitar. And it's just this fantastic view of Perry Mason as representing a moment where we changed from family businesses and the Perry Mason office being a kind of family to a more kind of cruel, harsh, capitalist kind of work. And it's just brilliant about the whole world of Perry Mason and the genius of it. So thank you, Nathan. And I heartily recommend The Little Church of Perry Mason by Dave Hickey.
Great. Thank you. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks to our producer, Vera Lynn Williams. The executive producer of Slate Podcasts is Steve Lichtai. Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of the Panoply Network, and our intern, Daniel Schrader. The XX Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out the entire roster of shows at itunes.com/panoply. Our show page for more information about the show can be found at slate.com/xx. Our Facebook page, facebook.com/XXGabFest. Many of you have been going on to Facebook to discuss our show and recommend topics for us to discuss. Or you can email us, which you have been doing, thank you, at XXGabFest@slate.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes or any place where you get your podcasts, and leave comments so more people can find out about the show. For June and Noreen, I'm Hannah, and we will see you in a couple of weeks.